Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and call the Senate Committee on Judiciary to order. Thank you very much for being here. What I want to do is go through the agenda that we have, because some of the bills that we have scheduled for work session today are not going to be able to move because we're waiting for paperwork. So those who are here on House Bill 2310A, House Bill 3365A, House Bill 3399A, and House Bill 3452A. Those four bills will not be able to move forward today because we do not have the paperwork. All of those four bills will be carried over to tomorrow's agenda. That will be for Tuesday, June 2nd, those four bills. Regarding the other work session bills that I have currently on, 2357A and 3093A, chair plans on moving those today unless I get word back from legislative council that there's a hiccup. I don't think there is, so hopefully we'll get those done once I get legislative council back up here to confirm my desires. With that, we're going to go ahead, and I know that we have public hearings and possible work sessions on House Bill 2225A, 2227, and 3206A. We also have a public hearing and possible work session on 2845A. What I'm going to do is start at the top of the agenda. So we're open up a public hearing on House Bill 2225A. Chairman
Klonsky, members of the committee, House Bill 2225A comes to you from Representative Hoyle and Representative Gilliam. It allows a circuit court judge to authorize the execution of a search warrant outside of the issuing court's judicial district if the search warrant relates to or if the search relates to elder abuse offenses and the object of the search is financial records and the proper place for trial is not yet known. There are no amendments. There's no revenue and a minimal fiscal impact.
All right, thank you. Matt Smith is here to give testimony. Matt, why don't you come forward? While Matt's coming up, is there anyone else who will want to testify on House Bill 2225A? Good morning, Matt.
Good morning. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Matt Smith, and I'm the Detective Sergeant with the Forest Grove Police Department. I serve on the Washington County Major Crimes Team, the Washington County Elder Abuse Multidisciplinary Team, and most recently I served on the Governor's Work Group involving Elder Abuse Prevention. It is this work group ultimately helped craft House Bill 2225, and I'm urging each of you to vote in favor of this important piece of legislation. This bill, 20 years ago, would have been completely unnecessary. Currently, venue for an elder abuse case in Oregon is determined by where the suspect resides. In the past, this just simply required a police officer to track down fraudulent purchases or transactions by reviewing video footage at bank branches, interviewing store clerks, obtaining receipts, or talking to any other person that might have facilitated a financial transaction in person. Today, virtually every citizen is carrying a mini computer with them every day in the form of a smartphone. Many citizens, myself included, use these devices to transfer money, pay bills, and even make investments. Criminals are using these devices too, and they're using them to steal and leave only a virtual paper trail that we currently don't have access to in certain circumstances. There's no witnesses to interview, no trail to follow, a dead end on day one. Now imagine being a criminal investigator and all you have is a victim suffering from dementia. They can't provide consent for you to look at their bank records, to review the financial information that would give you those clues. And in many cases, they don't even realize they're crime victims to begin with. Nearly all of my elder abuse cases involve the electronic transfer of funds in one form or another. In many instances, these transactions do not reveal who the suspect is, where the transactions occurred, or where the suspect resides. In a sense, I'm left in a kind of a limbo as to where the venue is where I can deliver a search warrant affidavit and search warrant to. In essence, all the data that law enforcement needs to conduct a comprehensive investigation is locked in the electronic records of banks, and it's impossible to determine where I should deliver my search warrant affidavit to. In one case, I was literally driving between Washington County and Yamhill County trying to get somebody to sign a search warrant where probable cause existed, but I couldn't show where my suspect was residing at the time, so venue was in doubt. House Bill 2225 would allow me and investigators like me to collect and document all the necessary evidence and deliver it to a circuit court judge. The purpose of this bill is to not circumvent the judicial process. Quite the opposite. This bill is designed to allow investigators to deliver their affidavit to a judge and obtain a warrant in order to gather the necessary evidence, document the evidence in an affidavit, and have the information reviewed by a judge, and ultimately deliver a comprehensive investigation to whatever entity or venue the crime occurred at. The key word here is a complete case. This bill will prevent cases from stagnating and from victims from being victimized further. I've had numerous cases stall because I could not complete the basic work on a criminal case due to this small procedural loophole that's developed over the last 20 years just by the advent of technology. This bill only applies to cases involving victims who are 65 years or older and is designed to be very narrowly focused. The only thing we're seeking here is financial records in those instances. Not only that, this legislation was crafted with significant input from the Oregon Criminal Defense Attorneys Association. As an investigator and as a boot on the ground, I'm excited by the prospect that each of you will vote in favor of this bill and allow us in law enforcement to conduct the investigations that our seniors need and deserve. And I urge each of you to vote in favor of this bill. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Questions? Matt, thank you very much. Again, I'm going to ask if anyone else wanted to give testimony on House Bill 2225A. Not seeing anyone coming up. We'll close the public hearing. And we'll go ahead and open up a work session on House Bill 2225A.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2225A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2225A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Senator Gelser, will you be the carrier on this bill, please? And we'll close the work session on House Bill 2225A. And we'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 2227.
Chair Prasansky, members of the committee, House Bill 2227 comes to you from Representative Hoyle and Gilliam at the request of the Oregon Elder Abuse Prevention Work Group. In the 2014 legislative session, we passed House Bill 4151, which revised the definition of sexual abuse. One change specified that sexual contact between an employee of a facility and an elderly person is abuse, but consensual sexual contact between an elderly person and a paid caregiver is not. This was an attempt to recognize situations in which intimate partners, one may be a caregiver for another, but they choose not to be married. This measure, however, inadvertently created the possibility that sexual contact between an elderly person and a spouse, when the spouse is an employee of a facility, may become sexual abuse if the other spouse is a resident of the facility. So House Bill 2227 attempts to correct that by specifying that sexual contact between an elderly person and the employee of a facility is not sexual abuse if they are spouses.
All right. I have Fred Steele. Mr. Steele, why don't you come forward while he's coming up. Is there anyone else who will want to testify today on House Bill 2227? Good morning.
Morning, Chair Prasansky, members of the committee. My name is Fred Steele with Department of Human Services, also one of our two representatives from DHS that are members of the Elder Abuse Prevention Work Group. Chana described what the bill does pretty sufficiently. I don't know if I have much more to add other than where this came up in particular with the change in the last year was in Eastern Oregon, and where a spouse very well could be an employee of a facility in which their other spouse ends up being a resident, more often than not in kind of a rehabilitation type setting for a short period of time. Pardon me. So with that, if I could answer any questions that you may have.
All right, questions. So I guess I'm just going to throw one out. You said this looked like it could have happened in Eastern Oregon. Are we saying that there was a situation where there was a spouse that was employed at a facility and their spouse was admitted into the care facility?
As I understand it from Adult Protective Services staff, pretty much anywhere outside of our metropolitan areas, when the legislation passed last year in House Bill 4151, and we were going through our administrative rulemaking process and implementing the change, that's where it was raised, was in those more rural areas, because it's common. They conveyed to us it is commonplace to have the spouses as an employee and a resident. And quite frankly, they were concerned that they would end up investigating, consensual sexual contact in those settings.
Okay,
so a case hadn't actually occurred, but it was understood that it probably would eventually.
All right. I just want to put a little bit more on the record than what we've got, so I appreciate
sure.
that.
Sure. And, you know, one other thing to add to that, you know, based on that question, is that we did, in that administrative rulemaking process, we had confirmed and checked with Department of Justice and our legal counsel there to check to see if there was some spousal exception somewhere else in statute that would override this sex abuse definition for that, you know, for, you know, recognizing consensual spousal sex, and that we were told no, that the sex abuse definition would override any spousal exception that existed at anywhere else in statute. So,
all right. Any other questions or comments based on this little dialogue? All right, Fred, thank you very much for coming forward. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2227. Senator Cruz, I'm going to open up a work session on House Bill 2227.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 2227 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2227 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Senator Cruz will be the carrier. And we'll close the work session on House Bill 2227. And then I'm going to go ahead and jump down, because I only have one witness on the next one. This is going to be House Bill 2845A.
Chair Prasansky, members of the committee, House Bill 2845A was sponsored by Representative Klim. This deals with guaranteed asset protection waivers, or called GAP waivers. This is a product a consumer may purchase when they buy or lease a new vehicle, and it's intended to pay the difference between the amount owed under a financing agreement and either the amount covered by auto insurance or the value of the vehicle immediately before lost or theft. Currently, GAP waivers are considered an insurance product and most of the time, and are subject to oversight by the Department of Consumer and Business Services. House Bill 2845A specifies that GAP waivers are not insurance products, and then specifies the parameter for their sale, including what disclosures are required and how refunds may be completed, and makes it subject to the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. There are proposed A6 amendments which clarify that the cost of the GAP waiver must be separately stated in finance agreements in all circumstances. They require the creditor to pay the borrower a pro rata refund of any amounts due upon termination of the financing agreement without requiring the borrower to submit a claim for the refund. And it clarifies the action under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. It is not ready to move today with the A6s.
All right, Sean, why don't you come forward? While Sean's coming up, is there anyone else who wants to testify on House Bill 2545A? Good morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Sean Miller, I'm here today on behalf of the Guaranteed Asset Protection Alliance. It is a in support of House Bill 2845. The group is basically finance, the finance arms of the auto manufacturers. And so an example of this is Ford Motor Credit, who, and as Chan illustrated, it is currently an insurance product in Oregon, but it's also sold as non-insurance products at banks and credit unions. And so they are authorized to also sell this product. So basically the bill just allows the ability, just like in 48 other states, the ability for the auto manufacturers during the sale of an automobile through their finance agreements to be able to offer that product called GAP waiver. And so, again, this is the amount, if the amount the borrower owes exceeds the amount the vehicle is worth, if somehow the vehicle is totaled, it covers that gap in the auto finance agreement. On OLIS, Mr. Chair, I know we have a section by section. We've been working on this bill for about 4 years with consumer advocates, and there's various there's a section by section analysis. I'll just touch on a couple. Section 3 in the bill basically sets forth the method of determining how much will be waived. The series of disclosures that are required. Again, this is a completely voluntary product, so consumers have a choice to buy this product or not, and the proper disclosures need to be identified at that point. 2 years ago, I think what held up this bill from the consumer advocate standpoint was they were concerned about what could be charged, and so there is a cap in the bill. So there's actually a limitation on what could be charged by the auto dealers. And then from the enforcement standpoint, we have agreement on the Unfair Trade Practices Act, and we've worked with the Attorney Generals on that. So we've worked with DCBS along, you know, in the beginning developing this as we developed a language. They're neutral on the bill, I believe, and so is the Attorney General's office. I did receive the Dash A6 amendment, so I will comment. I noticed the clarification on the UTPA is correct. That's what we have agreed to on the House side. And then I know they did make a requested change on refunds, which I think is a policy committee of the committee, basically saying that a refund is required without submitting a claim for the refund. And so if there is a termination, that refund automatically transpire. And so that's obviously a policy committee and request by the DOJ. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to answer any questions. Again, this bill passed unanimously in the House and 60-0 vote on the floor, and would ask the committee to move this bill forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? John, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing. I understand we can't work that today because we've got some other stuff we need to do. So we'll be carrying over the possible work session till tomorrow, June 2nd. So we'll make certain we are covering those bases. And with that, we'll close. We'll close House Bill 2845A, and we're going to go ahead and open up our public hearing on House Bill 3206A.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, House Bill 3206A comes to this committee from Senators Przanski, Representative Williamson, Leiniger, and Barker. It has no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact. It modifies Oregon's post-conviction DNA testing procedures. The bill authorizes the availability of testing to all felony offenses. It requires the defendant to identify the evidence to be tested with as much specificity as is practicable. It requires the defendant to make a prima facie showing that the exculpatory evidence would lead to a finding that the person is actually innocent of the offense. It limits victim testimony in motion practice for testing. It changes when testing can be completed by labs other than the Oregon State Police. It requires the court to make written findings when denying a motion for testing, and it clarifies the role of court-appointed counsel in aid of motions for testing. It passed the House 57-0. It's not ready to move. There's one clerical amendment that an original version of the bill authorized testing for when someone was actually innocent of an enhancement fact. That has been worked out of the bill, but there's one remnant still in the bill that we need to omit before it's ready to move.
Okay. All right. With that, I have a number of people who are scheduled to testify today. I'm going to call up the first panel, Alyssa Kaplan, Steve Wax, and Ted Bradford. Good morning to all. I'm not sure who would like to start.
Good morning. I think Ted's going to start.
Okay.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Ted Bradford, and I live in Yakima, Washington. I am Washington State's first DNA exoneree. My case started in 1996 when I was wrongly convicted and sentenced to 10 years in prison for a crime I didn't commit. And that crime was first-degree rape and first-degree burglary. My case is a false confession case. I understand false confessions contribute to roughly one quarter of the wrongful convictions in this country. My story started in 1996, April 1st, where I was picked up and asked by two detectives with the Yakima Police Force if they asked if I would come down to the station with them and help them with the case that they were working on and answer a few questions. So I willingly went with them thinking, you know, I was helping them solve a case or, you know, help them out in any way I could. We got to the police station and
I was read my Miranda rights, signed a waiver, and then I realized I was there for not just to help them out, but I was under suspicion for this crime that they were investigating. And I was put in a small room, a small interview room, for almost 9 hours, where the whole day was just constant accusations of, where were you at this day? I told them, well, if it was on this day, because the crime occurred on a Friday, and so I told them, well, if it was a Friday, I would have been at work, because at that time I worked the job Monday through Friday. And they came back and said, well, no, we've looked into it. You missed work that day. And they asked if I wanted to take a polygraph, if I would be willing to take a polygraph. And I said, yes, you know, let's get this done. I didn't do it. I'll do whatever you need. So I agreed to take the polygraph test. When they were done with that, they brought me back into the room, and they told me that I had failed it. And they said, well, you need to start telling us what happened. You need to start telling us the truth. And so I kept telling them over and over. I couldn't even count how many times I told them I didn't do it. I'm not the guy you're looking for. And each time they kept telling me, we know you're the guy that did this. You're not leaving this room until you tell us what happened, until you start telling us the truth. So as the day went on, you know, I had nothing to eat the whole day. Nothing to eat. I think at one point they brought me a glass of water. And so towards the end of the day, it was getting to be about 4 or 5 in the afternoon. You know, they start making promises like, well, if you give us a statement, we'll go get you something to eat. Anything you want, just name it. And throughout the day, they also were telling me that the perpetrator of the crime had left DNA evidence at the crime scene. And they kept telling me throughout the day that they were going to have that tested, and it was going to prove that I did it. And, you know, I was thinking, I know I didn't do it. So that if they do the testing on this, it's going to prove my innocence. And so at the end of the day, you know, I was exhausted, terrified. It was, you know, it was a very scary situation to be in, you know, having these two detectives in a small room and you're backed into a corner and they're threatening you with all these punishments and accusations. And so I just wanted out of that situation. That was my only goal. And so again, thinking, well, if they do the testing, I'll be fine. So I agreed to make a statement. It was a coerced statement. It was a false statement. And it was the only part of the whole day that was actually recorded. It wasn't videotaped. It was just recorded on audio cassette. And so, you know, a lot of the promises that they were making were, you know, they would ask me, well, Ted, what's important to you? And I would tell them my family, you know, my job. And so they would say things like, well, if you give us a statement, you can go home to your family. You can go to work tomorrow. And at the end of the day, after I gave the false confession, gave them the statement, you know, they took me to jail, and, you know, I never did make it home. Not for 10 years. They took me to trial in June of 1996, and before the trial, they did test the evidence at the crime scene. And at that time, the state patrol came back and said, well, there's nothing to be found. There's no evidence. And so what they had been telling me that whole time in the interrogation about there being evidence to be tested, you know, it was... That was what I was hoping on. That was my way out of it. And so going to trial, there was no DNA evidence at that time. And all they had was the false confession. And so I was convicted based on that and sent to prison for 10 years. And while I was in prison, you know, I continued my appeals, exhausted all my appeals. And I, you know, I was starting to lose hope. You know, I thought I would never get out of that situation. In 2002, this would be about 5 or 6 years into my sentence, the Innocence Project took on my case, the Innocence Project Northwest, based in Seattle. And they immediately started asking that testing be done in my case. And from what I understand, at that time in Washington State, the prosecutor's office had complete say in who is allowed testing and who is not. And that in itself was a struggle because we had to get that okayed. And from what I understand, the Innocence Project Northwest had to actually go to the legislature and get the laws changed to where myself and a few other people that were locked up could even get the testing done. And so all this time, you know, I was still locked up. I was, you know, still trying to get out of the, you know, out of this whole mess. And I was released in 2005, completed my sentence. I was sentenced to 10 years. I did 9 years and 4 months and 25 days. And so I was released back into Yakima, the city I was from, and I was released as a level 3 sex offender. You know, my name was in the newspapers. And that was because, largely in part, because I refused treatment while I was in there. And I kept telling them while I was in prison, I didn't do this. Why should I have to go to treatment for something that I never even did? And so after being released, when I got locked up, I was married at the time. We had two small children, both under 2 years of age. And so when I got released, they were in grade school. And when you get released as a level 3 sex offender, they put your name and picture in the paper. They post flyers. They hand out flyers to all the schools. So my two children, you know, were traumatized by that because they got mercilessly picked on by all the kids in school. And they just went through hell. And so it took a long time, but they eventually were able to get the DNA testing done on the crime scene evidence in my case. And what they had found was that there was an unknown male DNA profile on the evidence. And where they had found that was on a mask that the perpetrator had brought to the crime scene. And what he had done apparently was... put some black electrical tape over some eye holes on a mask. And that had been in the evidence that whole time, the evidence locker where they store the evidence. And they were able to get his DNA profile from the sticky side underneath the tape that had been undisturbed all this time, like 10 years. So that was great news. From what I understand, they couldn't do that kind of testing back in 1996 when I was convicted. But they were able to do it then. And so the Innocence Project Northwest, they filed a motion, writ of habeas corpus, I think it's called, asking for the right to a new trial based on this DNA evidence that they newly discovered. And so in 2006, it went back to court in Yakima County, and the judge ruled that I did deserve the right to a new trial based on this new DNA evidence. And the next year, my case was overturned. Charges is, you know, erased. But the prosecutors decided to retry me. So, yeah. In 2008, they came to my house, told me I was under arrest for the same crime, handcuffed me, took me to jail. I spent the night in jail. And, it, you know, it was like deja vu. Here it's all happening again. Luckily, the judge the next morning at my arraignment released me on OR. I say thankfully he did that because the second trial didn't take place until 2010. So that would have been like a year and a half, almost 2 years that I would have spent had he set my bail at a high rate, because if I didn't get released on OR, I would have been stuck in jail for a year and a half. So in 2010, the second trial finally gets underway, and it's just a scary situation to be in, you know, because at this time they had actually bumped up the charges to aggravated rape and aggravated burglary. So if I would have been found guilty at the second trial, they could actually send me back to prison for something I didn't do. And so thankfully, February 11th, 2010, after this second trial, after 15 years of my life lost, missing out on my kids growing up in their first days of school, and just, you know, losing my life for 15 years. So after all of this, I was finally acquitted. And exonerated. So I want to thank you for, you know, listening to me, allowing me to speak today. I support this bill and, you know, any bill like it, because I urge you to pass it, because, you know, the struggles that I went through, nobody should have to. You know, it shouldn't have taken that long to get to where I am today. You know, I'm free, and I just want to thank you.
All right, Mr. Bedford, I want to thank you for the committee for coming forward and being willing to give your story today. Before we take any questions, we want to see if the other panelists are going to make statements.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thanks. Good morning, Chair Przanski and members of the committee. My name is Aliza Kaplan. I am a professor at Lewis and Clark Law School and the co-founder of the Oregon Innocence Project. Just about a little bit more than a year ago, the Oregon Innocence Project became the first program in the state dedicated to investigating wrongful convictions. And I am here today to support House Bill 3206. And I thought I'd give you a little bit of a background and then pull out a few highlights of some of the changes. Since the first DNA exoneration in 1989, DNA evidence has transformed the fabric of our criminal justice system. And as of today, it has helped to prove the innocence of 329 wrongfully convicted individuals like Ted. Oregon actually was one of the earlier states to enact a post-conviction DNA law in 2001 to provide a clear legal avenue for those who are wrongfully convicted to access the DNA technology. Now, 50 states have those laws, and we can learn a lot from those laws, especially the ones that were enacted more recently, and we've learned how our statute can be improved. We know that in the 14 years since Oregon passed the law in 2001, only one request for testing has ever been granted. 3206, with its changes, would create a statute that works more effectively to allow people like Ted and those who might be wrongfully convicted here in Oregon prove their innocence. So just to pull out a few of the changes, the highlights, 3206 would create a more reasonable standard to access testing. The current law directs a court to find testing if there is a reasonable possibility that the testing will produce exculpatory evidence that would establish the innocence of a person, of the person. This current standard creates a catch-22. It essentially requires the person to prove his or her innocence before testing is granted, when the whole point is to determine guilt or innocence after the testing results are in. So 3206 creates a more fair standard by requiring the court to assume that the test results would be exculpatory and by permitting a court to grant testing if it would lead to a finding of actual innocence. This change would permit testing in cases where DNA testing by itself would not necessarily prove innocence, but could be a part of the puzzle in proving someone's innocence. Another change, House Bill 3206 would allow defendants who are no longer incarcerated to apply for testing for the same crimes as those who are currently in prison. Under the current law, someone who is incarcerated is eligible for testing for crimes such as kidnapping and robbery, while a person who has been released, like Ted, when he got his testing after he was already out, would not be eligible at the same for the same crimes. As Ted just described, being out of prison can end someone's, you know, initial nightmare, an innocent person's initial nightmare, but it will likely, he or she will likely face collateral consequences, right, until his or her innocence is proven. So things like housing, employment, sex offender registration, social stigma, all of those things are still on a person when they're out of prison. So 3206 would allow incarcerated and non-incarcerated people eligibility for testing if they've been convicted of aggravated murder or a felony. So basically make that an equal, whether you're in or out. This would also bring Oregon in line with 36 other states and ensure that a person would not be excluded if advances in technology could prove innocence after they've been released from prison. And finally, 3206 would promote transparency by requiring a judge to state the reasons for denying a motion for testing. We know that the majority, if not all except for, you know, one, of the requests have been denied, but we don't know why. In 2013, the legislature did revise the law to allow defendants to appeal if they've been denied testing. And we know that at least 18 people have asked OPDS to file appeals, but we don't have any details about why people's motions were being denied. So 3206 would require the judge to state the reasons why, and understanding why judges are denying these requests would enable attorneys to file stronger petitions the first time around and could help reduce the number of appeals. And then just to add more generally, as was mentioned, the Legislative Fiscal Office projected that 3206 would have minimal fiscal impact, and it would not change the existing requirements that all non-incarcerated individuals pay for testing, and that incarcerated individuals would pay for testing if they are financially able to do so. It would not create any additional evidence preservation requirements. And in 36 other states that do not have an incarceration requirement, none have reported a flood of litigation or any real major change with the openness to incarcerated versus non-incarcerated of people filing. So the main point is that 3206 would fulfill the intended purpose of Oregon's post-conviction DNA testing statute and to ensure that our justice system can correct wrongful convictions when they occur. Thank you so much for your time today, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Steve?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak. I'm Stephen Wax. I'm the legal director of Oregon's Innocence Project. I have been since last October when I retired after 31 years as Oregon's federal defender. I'm here to testify in support of HB 3206, and I thought that it might help to walk you very briefly through how the amendments would work in reality. The current statute, as Ms. Kaplan has indicated, as we see it, is too stringent. The amendments that are proposed and that the House has enacted will make the testing process more consistent with the reality of our justice system. It's critical, I think, to keep in mind that the focus of the statute will remain on innocence. The statute, as proposed to be amended, has a number of steps that a petitioner must still go through in order to get testing, and then once testing has been granted, if the court finds that, then to actually get to and through a motion for a new trial. At the outset, a person can file a motion seeking the assistance of counsel in order to file the motion for testing. If a person files a motion for counsel, the focus is on innocence. The person must say, "I'm innocent. Please give me a lawyer to help me frame the motion." In framing the motion for testing, again, the focus is on innocence. One of the changes that is significant, we believe, is the change from specific evidence to you have to say with as much specificity as practicable what it is that you want tested. The reality that we have is a situation in which a petitioner sitting in prison is not likely to know, for example, how many swabs were taken from a victim, where those swabs are. If what needs to be tested is the sweater that had the blood on it, or the pants that had the semen on it, or the actual swabs that were taken, or the vials of blood. So that's one of the practical changes that we see as important. Another practical change, I think, is something that is very easy to see from Mr. Bradford's case, and that is that what a person would need to state and to show the court in order to get the court to hear a motion for testing is that if the evidence is in fact exculpatory, that is helpful to the person, it would lead to a finding that the person is innocent. The reason lead to is important is that there are very few cases out there in the country or that would exist here in Oregon in which a test would demonstrate conclusively in and of itself that someone else committed the crime. That's just not how this works. As in Mr. Bradford's case, the test was able to show, in his instance, the unidentified DNA of another person as having worn the mask or handled the mask or the tape on the mask that the perpetrator used. That's going to be the reality in most situations, that the testing will open up other avenues of investigation. Once a person can frame that and tell a court, this is why I want testing and this is how the testing could show I'm innocent, then the court has to make that finding. The prosecutor can respond, there can be argument, there can be testimony if the prosecutor wants it. Not a simple matter. If the court then can actually find and conclude that the allegations put out by the petitioner are valid, then you get to the next hurdle, and that is a motion for a new trial. The fact that testing has been granted doesn't open the floodgates. There's another entire process that a petitioner would need to go through And the standard on a motion for new trial is quite high. It's a well-accepted standard in the criminal law. And what this statute does is say that a person, to get the testing, would need to meet that very high standard. So in reality, those are the steps that we see are important, the hurdles that still remain in order for a person to get a lawyer, get testing, and get a new trial. I'm happy to answer any questions if the committee has any.
Questions? Senator Thatcher first.
You mentioned that there isn't a big flood of people coming forward, which is interesting. So is this law based on what other states have done, or is this specifically tailored to Oregon, or kind of all the above?
Well, I would say it's a combination. I mean, as I mentioned, 50 states currently have now on the books a post-conviction DNA law. And it's a mechanism for someone who is sitting in prison or hopefully out of prison would have eligibility as well under the new changes. And in 36 states they do, to bring a claim and say, you know, and ask for DNA testing so they can help prove their innocence. So there are tons of similarities in the 50 states and, you know, our law and the one we're proposing, the changes. But, you know, in my opinion, every state does need a mechanism because technology changes and people and it's very difficult, as Ted described, when you're sitting in prison to prove your innocence. We don't have in our system very many avenues to do that. So if DNA can help you do that, then we want a good law and a good, fair law on the books that would allow someone to bring that claim. So there are similarities, of course, to other state laws, but this one has, you know, we've looked at the law we've had on the books that hasn't really been helpful to people, and we've made changes that will be helpful to someone in Oregon.
So, yeah, I just want to follow up. I think that's, to me, a key point. We already have a law. We're now updating it to basically tailor what we don't have versus what other states have and what has shown better results or success of actually allowing someone to prove their innocence.
Right. And it's still fulfilling the same original mission, which is to provide an avenue for someone who is innocent and in prison or hopefully out of prison under the new changes to prove their innocence. And we do have the ability to look at the other states and say, this is what's worked, this is what's changed over time. So that's been helpful.
Yeah, thank you, because I was imagining that, you know, if you're in prison, you don't have much else to do, I imagine, but mm-hmm. say I didn't do it. And there, I imagine there are a lot of people that said they didn't do it that actually did.
That's
and so
true.
I was picturing that there would be a flood. So it's good to know.
And we, you know, one of the things we did when looking at other states, you know, just to give you some, and one example, I didn't want to waste too much time, but we've looked at every other state and looked at our changes. So, for example, the non-incarceration provision that we hope will be in a new version of this law, you know, 36 other states do not have this incarceration requirement that we currently have. You know, a couple examples, Nebraska doesn't have it, and they've only had 25 petitions since 2001, right? That's their total. In Arizona, 43 petitions were filed between 2000 and 2009. So we're not seeing any flood at all, financially or otherwise. And but we, if there's that one person that needs it, like a Ted, then we want them to be able to have as much as they can under the law to prove their innocence. And that's what this would do. Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you all very much. Ted, again, thank you very much for coming here today and giving us your perspective and a real-life example of this scenario. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. We have Aaron Knott, Kevin Campbell, and Russ Rattle.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Attorney General in the Oregon Department of Justice, here in support of House Bill 3206. And this bill will, I think, constitute the biggest swing that the Department of Justice has had in this session. We were very concerned about this bill in the first chamber, and virtually all of the reasons for that concern have been put to rest. And that's the result of very hard work that happened on the other side. And in response to Senator Thatcher's comment, I think we at the Department of Justice had the same concern, which is, how do you strike the appropriate balance between exonerating people that didn't commit the crime for which they were committed, which is an interest as important as any other we have, with the possibility that people in prison will file motions for DNA tests, as you put it, because they don't have much else to do. And that was one of several core questions we tried to answer, and I think we did a good job. But just to give you a sense of a few of those procedural refinements, there are about a dozen of them, so I won't list them all. But number one, first of all, you have to offer up a very specific theory of why you're innocent. And that theory actually goes through judicial testing, meaning not only is there a judge evaluating whether that theory is plausible, the state gets the opportunity to rebut that theory. And that's important. That means that the district attorney can go through their own folders, their own files, find every bit of evidence, testimonial evidence, other physical evidence besides DNA, that contradicts what this defendant is alleging about why they're innocent, and bring that forward. And if they don't convince the judge to the judge's satisfaction, that's it. It stops there. Second of all, they have to say, as Mr. Wax testified, they have to articulate what they want tested. And this is important. They can't just say, there may be blood, saliva, whatever, somewhere in the state's possession. I want to test everything. They have to say, listen, it's this substance, it's at this location, and it proves my innocence in this way. And that, again, will be exposed to the rigor of cross-examination by a district attorney who will be motivated. These are serious crimes. By definition, these are felonies. Another point that was not mentioned, and I think this really is an Oregon gloss on a national question, I was very concerned, the Department of Justice was very concerned about the victims in these cases. No matter what happens in an exoneration case, the victim is going to experience the potential for additional trauma. Keep in mind, if a person is exonerated, that has the most profound effect on them. But second only to that defendant, I think, is the effect on the victim. You learn that the person who you thought committed this violent act against you and who has been in prison potentially for a long period of time didn't do it to a scientific certainty. And so our concern was we didn't want victims being brought into this process early before a test had been issued. So we inserted a provision in here that I think is very much consistent with the way Oregon approaches victims' rights, which is a victim cannot be brought in prior to a test coming back with exculpatory evidence when a defendant is alleging this is my theory of evidence without that victim's consent. And that's hard and fast in the statute. If the victim does not want to testify, does not want to be involved, they don't have to. They won't have to relitigate or relive what happened to them in that preliminary phase. There are quite a few other changes that I won't go into. DDA Ratto's written testimony does a very good job of outlining what they are, but I am proud to put the full support of the Department of Justice behind this bill.
All right, thank you. Who's going to go next?
Thank you. On behalf of the District Attorney's Association and Multnomah County District Attorney Rod Underhill, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Russ Ratto. I apologize for speaking somewhat slowly. I am somewhat of a turtle in my approach to the practice, and maybe that's come after 35 years of being a deputy district attorney. I try to be thorough, I try to be accurate, and I try to speak that way to you.
We call that due diligence, so that's fine. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, sir. In my 35 years, I've worked in a lot of different areas of the district attorney's office, and I've handled serious cases. Mr. Underhill created a new position in our office last fall to be a post-conviction deputy district attorney, and one of my responsibilities was to look at these DNA cases. It's also to work as closely as possible with the attorney general's office to handle and collect the PSRB cases and the PCR cases, post-conviction release cases, in a database and be responsive so that there's one person in the DA's office that works on those cases, and to work with the governor's office on clemency requests. But with regards to the DNA cases, I've had several that I've litigated. So I want to talk about briefly what those approximately dozen matters are, and my letter does address them, so I'll just touch on them, and then explain what my concerns are. And there are about three or four concerns, and that's reason why, on behalf of the organization and the district attorney, we remain neutral. There are many positive things in this change bill. And this bill, the engrossed version that came out of Chairman Barker's committee and the Judiciary Committee on the House side, they did great work at making these corrections from what the original proposal was by the Innocence Project. There is concern about the expansion of the class of persons that will be available to now seek DNA testing. And I'll explain that when I get back to this issue of what do we do when we look at cases and what will the defense be doing. The affidavits requirement is of a reasonable specificity. That's a good advance on the statute. To require the affidavit to request the test to establish a prima facie case that the DNA testing would, assuming exculpatory results, lead to a finding the person is actually innocent. This is good, but there are a couple of concerns. One, the statute provision would be aided if the words "by the motion court" was added so that it would be clear who's making that finding. The phrase "leads to," as in leads to a finding, we believe is ambiguous. The right of the state now to answer and refute the petitioner's request for DNA is important. When I looked at the appellate cases, the challenge was to the state's right to be heard, to provide information to the court. So this is a valuable addition to the statute. Allowing the motion court to permit testimony while also recognizing that the victim would have to consent. Those are two important additions, and it is a recognition of a victim right in the state. Deletion of the words "the vestige of prior statutes or of the conduct" is a good catch. Requiring the court to order DNA testing if there's a reasonable possibility, assuming exculpatory results, the testing will lead to finding that the person is actually innocent. Again, with the concerns previously noted, that still is important because the original version presented did not include the concept and deleted the original statutory concept of actual innocence. The statute now retains the state police as conducting the initial test and yet provides the court with the ability to authorize additional testing if the parties agree or the court finds otherwise. This is roughly consistent with the original statute, and that's to be supported. Having the court state reasons on the record seems like a positive addition to the statute and is to be supported. A lot of times the parties do sometimes look at a trial court and wonder what the basis of the ruling is. I know that the appellate courts also favor findings, fact, conclusions of law, and other kinds of motions, so this may be a productive outcome for the parties. It will involve additional work for the trial courts. And the right to counsel, in many instances, it seems that having an attorney on the other side can help to focus matters. In the matters that I've handled under the DNA statute, I'll order the DA file out of archives. I'll contact the police agency for police reports. I'll contact the property room to find out what evidence is available. I'll look and see what appeals have been filed. I'll ask for copies of the appellate briefs of both sides. If there has been a post-conviction relief action filed, and usually there is, I'll look for the post-conviction relief decision and contact the Attorney General's office. I'll look for trial memorandums of both sides. If there's appeal of the post-conviction court's decision, those briefs will be needed. And then there's the inevitable habeas corpus filed by the Federal Public Defender's Office, and I'll ask for the habeas corpus file. I'll review the PACER record, and I'll pull those documents up. We have an open book policy of discovery in the DA's office, so when an attorney calls me from the Public Defender's Office, I will provide them the information that I've obtained with regards to the DA file, the police reports, the evidence that's available, and that's what we're doing. So actual innocence is an important concept in looking at Oregon cases. Now, one reason why we may not have a lot of DNA challenge cases in Oregon is we have a good criminal justice system that looks to protect against wrongful convictions. And although if we look at Oregon against other states across the nation, we have that good system that I don't think other systems necessarily can speak to. There are other problems with the statute or concerns. The lack of a definition of the terms unfavorable, inconclusive, or exculpatory is one that may bring our interest back to this committee in future sessions. You know, one of the things to remember when I'm talking about pulling up that work to look at a case and a claim of a person who's saying that they're innocent, there are a lot of people in prison that claim that they are innocent. When you expand the class to all felons, the information that we're pulling up, going back in time and realizing there's no statute of limitations on this measure for the offender to make that request, that could be quite a challenge for a court system to apply those terms of what is an unfavorable DNA result, what is an inconclusive or an exculpatory result. Let me just briefly close by saying, you know, it's an adversarial system, and you as the legislature sit at keeping the field of law as a level field of law and not allowing it to tilt in one side's favor or another. And sometimes adversaries take it too far, and that's where the courts have to step in. But as a partner in the concept of criminal justice, we need you to keep this fair and level. The terrible story that we heard here was actually one of a DNA test statute working, because that allowed him to get to the point of developing the evidence that showed and proved his innocence. The fact that he was re-prosecuted, in my personal opinion, appears to be a flaw in the judgment of the DA, and you cannot change that judgment aspect of the system. It may reflect internal bias. It may reflect the ego of the people involved. I don't know, but your statute needs to keep that level playing field. Now, across the nation, the Innocence Project has not always been in the same unbiased circumstance presenting their cases. In Chicago, there's an example of fabricated evidence that led to an exoneration of a guilty murderer and then actually the framing of another person who was also innocent. So it's important that our law keep that playing field level, and it seems as though in your retaining this statute's focus on actual innocence, you have done that. The Judiciary Committee has done that, and the work of the Attorney Generals in working with those legislative members has done that. So thank you very much. I remain neutral on behalf of the organizations because of the concerns that I've expressed. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police. I'm here today in support of House Bill 3206. Recognizing some of the concerns that Mr. Ratto just mentioned and Mr. Knott. We are supportive of the bill because if there is a problem, if the net is clearly too large, that can be fixed in future sessions, and so we can keep an eye on that. I do want to thank the proponents, Aliza Kaplan and Bob Encine, Mr. Wax, along with Mr. Knott and Mr. Ratto for sitting down and really crafting a bill that I think reflects a good balance here. Like I said, in the future, there may be the need to relook at this, but we feel strongly that groups like the Innocence Project, groups like the Chiefs of Police and others have to stand on the same side of this question to the greatest degree possible, and that if there are people that should be exonerated because they're not guilty of the crime that they've been convicted of, we want to be on the side of justice in that regard. And if I know some of you were able to attend the event we sponsored, Chief Sheriffs and the Innocence Project, a couple weeks back, called Fighting for Justice Together, an evening with Jennifer Thompson. I think it's our goal to continue to work collaboratively in the future to make sure that in this regard, Oregon continues to be a progressive state. And that we stand on the side of ensuring that justice is the result. And I do agree with Mr. Ratto. I do believe that our system here in Oregon is an excellent system. And as a result, I'm hopeful that we'll have less cases that require the exoneration of somebody that's been convicted who is not guilty. That being said, time will tell. This opens the gate, so to speak, for additional challenges, and we'll see what happens. But, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we do support 3206, and thank the committee for your consideration today. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Questions for anyone on the panel? Gentlemen, thank you very much for coming forward. Our last two scheduled witnesses, Gil Meyer, Eric Blumenthal. And while they're coming up, is there anyone else who wants to testify on House Bill 3206A?
Do you want to go first? Okay. Chair Prasansky, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, giving our unquestioning and hearty support of the bill. I would just like to use this as an opportunity to make a call for all practitioners in the criminal justice system. And by that, I mean law enforcement, I mean prosecution, I mean the defense attorneys, I mean the judges, to please swallow a big, huge pill of humility and to acknowledge sometimes the system does get it wrong. In looking at the exonerations across the United States that have arisen since the DNA Innocence Project movement has started, there's been a lot of shock often at the exoneration of an individual. But that shock can sometimes come by and through the defense lawyer as well. There are certainly cases where the defense attorney was a very arduous, zealous, true advocate for their client. There are also, sadly, many instances when those defense attorneys did not believe their own client's innocence. You've heard the data repeated here that of those exonerations, they're finding about 25% of them have false confessions in them and or false guilty pleas. And it's really easy to take a sense of comfort and assurance from that. But I can speak for myself. 30 years ago, I had a client who swore he gave a false confession, and I just did not know how to absorb that information. I didn't really know what to do with it. And it hasn't been it's only been since the DNA exonerations have proven scientifically that this is a real phenomenon that I've even been able to begin to understand it myself. So when confirmatory bias sets in, and it can set in millions of different ways, and then you combine that with a defense lawyer who might be depressed, who might be very inexperienced, who might be simply overwhelmed with crushing caseload, that's just simply a very, very bad formula. So what's great about the bill is it acts as a quality assurance opportunity here. It opens the gateways to truth in those instances where there's a credible showing that there could be actual innocence at play, and it's a good bill. We urge your aye vote. Thank you.
Thank you. Eric?
Chair Prasansky, members of the committee, Eric Blumenthal. I'm an appellate attorney at OPDS, the appellate division. We're testifying in favor of 3206. I think as far as from the appellate perspective, it should lead to better records and more efficient appellate litigation. There's a few things I just wanted to talk about sort of from our perspective, how I've been working on a lot of these cases that have been coming through so far, and how we think that the changes that are being made by this bill are actually going to resolve a lot of the things that we're seeing, the problems, the hiccups that we're seeing up in the trial court. You know, the specificity on page 1, line 24, talks about the person identifying with as much specificity as reasonably practicable, the evidence to be tested. That reflects the reality that at this motion for testing stage, it's the very beginning of this process. A lot of times at that stage, some person doesn't know exactly what evidence is available. That usually comes through the process, through discovery, through investigation. And it really gives the trial court more flexibility, to direct the litigation to sort of figure out what can they test, how can we, how will this establish innocence down the road. Similarly, on the same note, on page 2 in line 11 and line 22, it talks about changes it to leads to a finding of innocence. Again, that gives the trial court, gives the parties opportunity to really just cut through the statutory language and actually get at what evidence needs to be tested, and if we test it, how could these results down the road, at the motion for new trial stage, combined with other evidence,
show that this person is either innocent or guilty. And it bears emphasis when we talk about, why would people, they have nothing better to do than to file motions for innocence, bears emphasis that if the testing is confirmatory, if the testing is inconclusive, or if it shows the person's guilty, those results are sent to the Board of Parole. And a lot of these cases, these guys are actually still subject to the Board of Parole. And so there are reasons why people wouldn't want to just, for the sake of anything, just file these motions, because then they're going to look more guilty. And it's not going to look great when they're looking for parole for them to say, I've been protesting my innocence all this time, and then these DNA test results and show that I've just been, lying this whole time about it. So there is sort of this go cut both ways in that regard. The other thing we want to talk about is on page 2, line 2, the state shall answer. I think, again, that's going to help get better records. Sometimes a lot of the appeals we get are sort of summary denials coming from trial courts where and again, some of that's also because we've had a lot of pro se litigation on this. But it'd be helpful on appeal to know why the trial court's denying it, and having the district attorney's position on the record makes that more easy. Similarly, the requirement that the trial court make findings is be much helpful, very helpful for appeals, because it'll make it so the appellate court can look at it and say, well, here's why the trial court denied it, and instead of having to engage in a little bit of guesswork there. And then finally, on page 3, line 11, the bill explains that the right to counsel applies at all stages. That's an important clarification. We've had a lot of denials of motions for counsel, because I think it's because the statute as it's currently phrased doesn't explain the scope of the right to counsel as well. And now it's very clear that a person can have appointed counsel at all stages of a DNA proceeding, and that's really critical, because this is complex litigation, and it's just, you can't expect an inmate, who, even if they're legally proficient, to have the sort of investigative resources to litigate one of these cases. So it's absolutely critical that we have counsel, and because counsel can weed out cases that don't have merit. Unless there's any other questions, that's it.
Questions? Thank you all very much for coming forward. We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 3206A, and this will also be carried over until tomorrow, based on paperwork, if I'm not mistaken. So we'll close that public hearing, and we're going to go ahead and go into our work sessions. At this point, I have first one will be House Bill 2357A.
Chair Brzezinski and members of the committee, House Bill 2357A modifies law enforcement defenses to crimes of unlawful possession of firearms and possession of firearms or dangerous weapons in a public building or court facility. It provides law enforcement with protections afforded to concealed handgun license holders. The bill applies both to honorably retired and off-duty police officers. It specifies that the bill only applies to parole and probation officers while they are acting within the scope of their employment. House Bill 2357A allows honorably retired police officers to cast an artificial light from a vehicle while in the immediate presence of a firearm or bow and arrow. It permits law enforcement to operate a snowmobile and all-terrain vehicle with a loaded firearm or bow and arrow, declares an emergency, and is effective on passage. We are considering the proposed -A3 amendments today, which have a minimal fiscal and no revenue impact. Those amendments provide that the affirmative defense does not apply if an officer is convicted of an offense that would otherwise make them ineligible for a concealed handgun license. Right. And we're ready to move today.
All right, thank you. Questions?
Mr. Chair, I was actually the requester for the -A3 amendment, and the purpose is to recognize the training that retired officers have, but also to exclude them from being able to take advantage of this ability to bring a gun into a public building. And if they do have that on their record, the affirmative defense is no longer available, which means that they are committing a Class C felony by bringing a gun into a public building.
Yeah, so in other words, if those individuals have, let's say, fallen out of grace and are no longer good standing, as we would say, they would not have that defense.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right.
Mr. Chair, I move the -A3 amendment into House Bill 2357A.
Senator Cruz moves the A3 into House Bill 2357A. Any discussion? Senator Thatcher?
Because I was looking at the bills ahead of time and looking at the sheet, even it says no amendment. So I didn't notice the A3 amendment. 2357, right?
That's correct.
Okay.
Chair Brzezinski and Senator Thatcher, it looks like an older staff measure summary was printed. However, you should have the dash A3 amendment in your packet up there.
All right. Never mind. A piece of paper behind it. Thank you.
Oh, yeah, that one.
Okay.
I'll give you a moment.
All right. Yeah.
All right. Any objections to the motion of adopting the A3s in the House Bill 2357A? Not seeing any, so ordered.
House Bill 2357A as amended by the dash A3 amendments to the floor to be passed recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2357A as amended by the A3s to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Further discussion?
Thank you. About time.
Any other comments? Any objections? So ordered. And it sounds like we have an enthusiastic carrier and Senator Thatcher.
Senator Berg, I sure would love to carry. No, I was kidding. I'll do it.
It's a done deal. All right. With that, we close the work session on House Bill 2357A. And we're now going to open up a work session on House Bill 3093A.
Chair Brzezinski and members of the committee, House Bill 3093A is the Concealed Handgun Reciprocity Bill. The bill provides persons licensed to carry a concealed handgun in another state the same protections afforded to persons with an Oregon concealed handgun permit, provided the issuing state handgun competency requirements are no less stringent than the Oregon requirements. It directs the Department of Justice to compile a list of eligible states and make the list available to law enforcement and the public. The bill specifies that a permit holder's home state must recognize Oregon's concealed carry permit for the law to apply. We are considering the proposed dash A7 amendments, which adjust the language concerning eligibility requirements to encompass all of ORS 166291 and ORS 166292, rather than just the handgun competency requirements that are contained in ORS 166291 sub 1 sub F. There is a minimal fiscal and no revenue impact with the A7 amendments, and we are ready to move on them this morning.
Dash A7 amendment into House Bill 3093A.
Senator Cruz moves the dash A7 amendments into House Bill 3093A. Discussion. Any objection to the motion? So ordered.
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 3093A as amended by the dash A7 amendment to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 3093A as amended by the A7s to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Thatcher.
Also about time.
All right. And any objections?
I object, Mr. Chair.
All right. Senator Burdick objects to the final motion. Motion carries. Chair will carry the bill to the floor, and we'll close the work session on House Bill 3093A. All right. Now, that pretty well takes care of what we have for today. I do want to go through and make certain that we have carried over all the other bills. We have a total of six that are being carried over. House Bill 3206A, House Bill 2845A, House Bill 2310A, House Bill 3365A, House Bill 3399A, House Bill 3452A. All right, everyone's going up and down with the bottom. Yes, that sounds good. So I think we got everything carried over, and those are all being carried over until tomorrow, Tuesday, June 2nd. We're scheduled to be here at 8:30. With that, colleagues, thank you very much, and we're adjourned. All right. The Congress.